Talking sports in the afternoon. This is The Big Show on Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
Give us a second here. We're having a splendid smoked meat sandwich here. It's the Doughboy, Bruce Dobigan with you. Josh Humphries alongside as well. His mouth is full, too. Mm-hmm. Will Nault promised us he'd have all sorts of filler and stuff so we could finish these sandwiches. We're live from Canyon Meadows, site of the Shaw Charity Classic. Underway. The morning group has gone through. Your leaders, ladies and gentlemen, drum roll. Joe Durant and Tom Pernice Jr. at 5 under par each. Not too bad. Not a bad score for the first round. I'm just glad it's today and not yesterday that we're sitting here at 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
This was about when the weather came in yesterday, wiping out most of the afternoon's activities here. Good news, the weather forecast seems to have changed a little bit. Doesn't seem to be rain in the forecast for the next 2 days. We got a clear day today. A little bit of fall crispness in the air, but that's good. Good for walking around. Comfortable. Sun out. Lots of people on the course.
Yeah, there's a lot of people here. It's nice here. Good weather. Lots of people coming around. And I'm in for a great day of golf. And you talked about the weather being probably perfect conditions for what you would want today.
Now, if you're heading to the course and you want to come by and see us or say hi, we're located just to the left of the first hole around the green. The eighth fairway runs behind us. We go right at the practice chipping green. The ninth green is just over here. So we're in a pretty good position to see people coming by. If you want to come by and say hi, we're fine, but we won't give you a sandwich.
No.
We're hoarding the sandwiches.
I'm waiting for the bread to get back in there, so
right.
I go again.
It is a Friday afternoon heading into the long weekend of Labor Day. What more could you ask for? Decent weather, great golf course. Freddie Couples on the course.
Yeah.
Stephen Ames just went out. He's in a group with Freddie Couples. Freddie had his approach shot maybe about 5 or 6 feet from the pin, all excited. Stephen Ames 60 feet from the pin. Well, a two-putt would be good. Ames drains the 60-footer, and then he goes gets the knucks from Mr. Couples after all. So they're developing a little bit of a rapport. They know each other from the tour. Stephen Ames, this is his first, as far as I know, this is his first Champions full event, having just turned 50 this year. Here in front of the home crowd, you got, you know, a little bit of jitters, a lot of familiar faces in the crowd. He'll look around and see people he knows. There'll be a bit of pressure because, A, he's come off of the regular tour, and people expect you to, like, eat this up when you've just come off the regular tour. Plus, he's in with Fred Couples, who is the people's church. That always makes you a little bit nervous. Mm-hmm. So, a nice start to the tournament, some nice scores. And as we go through the afternoon, Josh, I think we're going to hopefully have some people come in here. We're right next to the media tent, and so they'll be bringing people in, hopefully. And over the course of the afternoon, we'll grab them after they've done their media availability and hopefully talk to some of the people, let's say, from the morning group.
Yeah, that we get on. That would be good to hear some of these guys come on. Really cool to see how the course is playing for a lot of these guys coming up here.
Now, have you ever played here yourself?
Yeah. No, I've never played here either. I live close to it all the time, you know, for a long time, but never had the chance to play it. But always find it interesting to hear how these guys think of what a course here in Calgary compares to some of the other ones that they play on a regular basis.
Yeah, we had the gentleman who set up the course for the tour yesterday, two mornings ago, I guess, when I was with Boomer, and talking to him a little bit about it. And that's my curiosity, too. I mean, it's a Calgary course. I've been fortunate to play it a number of times, sort of have a sense of what the course is, to see where they, you know, where their drives land compared to where yours does.
Yeah.
See how they play things, et cetera. And sometimes when you're here live at a golf tournament, good players, it can be almost underwhelming because they're putting the ball in the right places, and they have nice smooth swings. There's nobody's throwing clubs. It's kind of, you know, it's quite very almost methodical when the good guys are doing it. And so sometimes it doesn't look as dramatic as you might think. But towards the end of the tournament, obviously, when the stakes are on the line, then we'll see some stuff. Now, are you a golf fan?
I'm a bit of a golf fan, yeah. I enjoy playing the game. I mean, not as into it as in other sports, but I definitely do enjoy watching and playing it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
This is a place to be, then.
Yeah, this is a place to be.
As I say, we'll keep you up to date on the scores as we go through the afternoon. We'll keep you updated on Stephen Ames in particular, but a couple of other Canadians who are on the course who people will be following. Jim Rutledge, we had him on Wednesday morning, came in. Great guy from the West Coast. And then from Niagara Falls, Rod Spittle,
nice.
Who is the guy who I think is basically single-handedly is ruining marriages around the golf world. and I don't mean this against Rod. Great guy, terrific interview. But if you haven't heard his story, He went to Ohio State on a golf scholarship from Niagara Falls, Ontario. So he's a Canuck. Still has the maple leaf on his back. Goes to Ohio State on a scholarship, and he's there with a couple of guys who've gone on to really good careers. But he decides, you know what, I'm married, I'm going to raise my kids, settle down with my wife. He got a job in the insurance business in Columbus, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And he was there for some odd years doing that, successful. And at about 45, he went to his wife and said, let's make a plan. I'm going to try and play on the senior tour. Now, every guy who's 45 years old who plays scratch golf probably thinks, you know what, when I get to 50, if I just go all in on this thing, I could do this. And that's what Rod Spittle did. And he got himself back into playing condition, qualified, got onto the tour after 50. Fair to middling, not making a ton of money. Mm-hmm. And then it seemed like maybe, you know, the dream that he and his wife had agreed on, maybe it wasn't going to work out. It was the final event, I think, of 2010 in San Antonio. And sure enough, don't you know, he wins the tournament.
Yeah.
And now he's made $2.5 million on the tour. So as I say, you have to think that there's guys all over town who are trying to convince their wives, you know, just let me go play golf for 5 years, get ready, and then you can come with me on the tour.
Yeah. There you go. And wouldn't that not be one of the greatest things to do? To play a tour like this, I mean, you come to lovely courses. I mean, again, that's interesting to see where Canyon Meadows ranks among some of the courses that these guys go, but wouldn't be a bad life at all, would it be, to turn around playing golf for a living?
Well, for the guys who've had it, like a Stephen Ames, who's basically the book is written on him. He won tournaments. He won a ton of money, mm-hmm. Competed for Canada, etc. It's not like he has to write a whole other chapter in his lifestyle. He's got all those things in his back pocket, as do so many of the guys out here. But then there are guys like Rod Spittle and some other guys who we'll talk about as we go through the afternoon, who are guys who have done the after 50 thing. And the money is a little bit important to them, and the prestige and to, you know, putting that up there is important to them. So to travel around and do this, the other thing about when you get to what they call senior level, if you don't know golf, over 50 is senior here on the Champions Tour. When you go around on this tour, the guys tend to travel with their wives and families because the kids are grown up.
Yep.
When you're a young guy in your 20s and 30s, of course, your kids are young. They can't come with you everywhere. It's a very different lifestyle. It's a much more strenuous, stressful lifestyle. And, of course, obviously the money is different. But here you get families. You get people out all the time. I don't know if you saw a couple of weeks ago when Bernhard Langer won the tournament. I think it was in Denver. I want to say it was in the Denver area. Doesn't really matter. But anyhow, he won because he's winning everything this year. And his daughter was caddying for him.
Yeah.
And they got to the 18th, and he sunk the putt that won the tournament, et cetera. And she took the flag off of the flag stick as a souvenir and walked off the course. And Bernhard turned around and said, wait, go back, put the flag back on. There's two more groups that have to play in. Now, on the big tour, if somebody did something like that, there'd be the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah,
the guy
would
be in the thumbscrew. The caddy would be in the thumbscrew in about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But everybody laughed. She put the flag back on. She got it later as a souvenir, and on they went. So you'll see that sort of thing around the course when you walk and see people here. You might see their families, their wives and kids and, mm-hmm. and parents and people like that following them.
Yeah, it definitely seems like it's a great kind of more relaxed atmosphere than the PGA Tour would be. I mean, everything's not, you know, things are still pretty serious because there's some big money. These guys want to win, still want to make a good living, and are trying to do that. But it seems like things, you know, like stories like that can happen, and some, you know, they're not as a huge story as they would be in all the pressure that you would see on the main tour.
Who are you interested in seeing? What players are you interested in seeing?
Oh, for sure. I mean, guys like Freddie Couples would be great to see
playing.
And then Stephen Ames, obviously, Calgarian local guy. Great to see those guys around. Steve Elkington, another guy we had on the show earlier this week on the morning show. Great to see just all those guys. I mean, it would just be great to settle up here early in the morning one day and just kind of hang out for the entire afternoon and the day and see all the different guys that come through here.
Yeah. Now, if you do come to a tournament like this, honestly, the best place to watch a golf tournament is on TV. Mm-hmm. You're going to see everything on TV. You won't be up close, and you won't be able to hear what they're saying, etc. But if you do come to the tournament, and I do recommend you do it because it's a lot of fun anyhow, the idea is to take a look at the landscape and figure out a place where you can see two or three holes, things happening all at the same time. So if you can be at some place where there's a green, mm-hmm. and then there's a tee box, and then maybe a little par three, all within sort of hailing distance, that's a good place to be. Then you see everybody as they come through.
Yeah.
And then maybe if you come a second day, follow a group. And because everybody will be following Stephen Ames and Couples, follow a group that has a smaller gallery.
Yeah.
And you'll hear the talk. You'll hear him talking to his caddy. You'll see what it's like to watch these guys and the way they play. Mm-hmm. And the thing that makes you sick, too, of course, even at this level is, you know, they'll be hitting, like, wedges 170 yards and stuff like that. You just want to gag, right?
Yeah.
So, anyhow. as I say, lovely day. Be a great day to come out. I believe you can still buy tickets.
Yep, I just believe so.
For the day and for the weekend. And this is not like a PGA tournament event, by the way. It's only 3 days. Mm-hmm. So today, tomorrow, and Sunday. Rocco Mediate is your defending champion. Always an interesting guy. Maybe we'll be able to get Rocco on.
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, I'm sure some guys will come through here.
He should stop. I read his book. I bought his book.
Well, there, someone should tell him that. And did you bring it with you?
I didn't.
Sign it for you.
I probably lent it to somebody. I don't know. I always lend books away to people. Anyway, Rocco's is an interesting story. And if you can somehow go through each of these people as they come through. John Cook, I believe, is one of the guys who went to Ohio State with Rod Spittle. Mm-hmm. I think he was in the same year as him. And John Cook, of course, has had an interesting career as well. Connections to Tiger Woods over the various years, etc. This is the generation of guys who were kind of established when Tiger came on the tour. The guys who are in their 50s now, they were the guys who were established people like Freddie Couples when Tiger Woods appeared. And Tiger just blew up the golf world.
Yeah.
He changed everything. He made these guys understand they had to be in more fit. He understood that he was mentally going to beat them in a way that they had never been challenged before. And they realized that the way he played the game, the distance, the style of game that he played was going to be the way of the future. And if they couldn't do that, they'd be left behind. And so, as I say, you're seeing these guys. I think they like it that Tiger's not here and Fred and Phil isn't here yet.
Yeah.
And that they have a shot at winning.
Yeah, I mean, that's for those guys, that's great. I mean, you talk about some of the skills you'll see here from these guys. It'll make your head shake just how far they can hit the ball, how accurate they can hit it compared to the everyday golfer. Just it shows you how difficult it is. And for me, it's always was golf was probably the one sport I think would be the toughest, maybe one of the hardest sports to become a professional at, because you have to be so good and you have to be so consistent with your shots. I mean, one bad shot could throw off a whole tournament for you. So for me, it was always that golf was probably the, I mean, at least in my opinion, it's one of the toughest sports to be really good at and be a professional at and have a lot of success at.
And you don't have any home games, per se. You know,
yeah, you're always on the road. Yeah.
Think of pro team sports, and you know, half your games are played in front of people who are rooting for you.
Yeah.
And you rarely get that sort of thing here on the tour. It doesn't happen all that often that you get people who are cheering for you. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the rookie guys will tell you the toughest thing in the first year or two on tour is learning about the travel. Where to stay when you get to a place? Is the course accessible? Is it a good course? Is it a bad course? I remember years ago, back when Stephen Ames was still talking to me, we were talking about the Pebble Beach, and I was saying, man, you're so lucky it was coming up to Pebble Beach time. He said, I won't go to Pebble Beach. And I said, why? He said, there's one road in and one road out, and it's always jammed. He said, it's an impossible weekend that way.
Yeah.
And he said, you can't stay anywhere near the course because the lodges are all full of the muckety-mucks.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, you know, I rethought how these guys see these things.
Yeah.
Where are the amenities? Can I get in and out of there quickly? Can I bring my family, et cetera? So those are a lot of the things that these guys talk about and they're concerned about. And once they get their feet on the ground and they sort of have a routine, it's all about coming into familiar places.
I mean, that for me would be one of the toughest things is the travel like that and, you know, organizing where you're going to stay or how you're going to get to and from the golf course each and every day while you're there. Because you're there essentially, you know, if a tournament's on the weekend, you probably arrive, what, the Monday or the Tuesday for some practice rounds. And then your first round is on the PGA Tour on the Thursdays. An event like this, you're on the Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But you got to figure out that's a week of, you know, where you're going to stay, how you're going to get back and forth, and a lot of stuff to get, you know, used to. So I can see those big courses like the ones that are difficult to get to. That maybe you see guys, you know, why is this guy not playing this weekend? Why is he taking this tournament off or not coming to this event? Well, I mean, it has a lot to do with some of the other things that we maybe don't think about. We look at it and say, well, it's a great tournament. Look at all the guys that are here. Why aren't more coming? Sometimes it's just not accessible or possible. These are still a real-life human beings who have to deal with all those things.
Yeah, and because the money's so big now, a lot of players, we've seen this on the big tour, we've seen guys playing a smaller schedule, a shorter schedule, because they don't necessarily... Steve Stricker only plays 15 tournaments a year, and a lot of people were sort of lamenting that and saying, well, he hasn't got enough points to get into the FedEx Cup and some other things like that.
Yeah.
They can afford to do that. They don't have to travel and play as much. And then you get situations like where you go and play the Open Championship in Britain, and if you want to play the Canadian Open, and anybody who has a Royal Bank sponsorship thing on his sleeve, you got to play in that tournament.
Yeah.
They have to get on like an overnight jet from wherever the Open is in Britain, fly back overnight to Toronto or Vancouver or Montreal, wherever the tournament is, and like be ready to go and play on a Tuesday and turn your whole body clock around that way and if you're a guy who hasn't necessarily played a course ever, sometimes you're going blind.
Yeah, and that could be a tough thing, it goes to say. I mean, of all the professions, I mean, it's not like a team sport where you can, if you're having a bad day, you can rely on a teammate to kind of pick you up, like in hockey or, you know, basketball, football, baseball even, you know, if a pitcher, I think baseball's a little more individual because it's everything starts from a stop, and if you're at the batter, you know, it comes to you, the ball comes to you, it's up to you. But when you're talking about golf, I mean,
I've never seen a guy come off a course and say, I had my man on that play.
Yeah, you're exactly right, and that's the thing. I mean, you're responsible for your own game, and that goes, you know, why maybe golf is one of the toughest things to be a professional at. The travel, there's no home games, you're by yourself, it's all about you. If you have a bad day, you know, it affects you, the money affects you, and you got to kind of worry about yourself. And it's pretty difficult to be a very good golfer. I think a lot of people listening and a lot of people know that, how difficult it is to be a really good golfer, and it's definitely the truth for an event like this. And if you come and get to see these guys, you'll see just how good it takes to be on a tour like this.
So we're going to be talking golf all this afternoon. And if we can get somebody, we'll grab them. We'll bring them in right away. Also keeping our eyes on other things that are going on. 3 to 4 o'clock, of course, is Football Fridays. Arash Madani will join us to talk a little bit about the big showdown on Monday afternoon, the Labor Day showdown between the Stampeders and the Eskimos. I couldn't believe this today. I was listening to the radio. I won't mention which channel, but I'll just say that it's one you pay for with your taxes. And the guy said, well, I see they've come out with their Labor Day uniforms for the Stampeders, and they've got cross pistols on their shoulders. Well, I don't think that's a very good image. I'm going, well, first of all, they've had the cross pistols for at least 10 years as part of their logo.
1994. Yeah. Ron Rook was on with us yesterday talking about the 1994 jersey. They had the cross pistols for 20 years now.
So this just in. And then I guess what he was trying to suggest is somehow that they're suggesting that Stampeders shoot people or that they're in favor of guns.
Yeah.
So anyhow.
I think it's just more of the Wild the West, the tradition of being in the Wild West kind of thing, where in the Western, you know, part of our city and our area's tradition and things like that. So
I heard Ron, and he was very eloquent on the subject. Anyhow.
Did you see the jerseys?
I haven't seen these are black ones, right?
The black ones, yeah.
I haven't seen it today. I didn't see the picture.
They are very nice, and the Stampeders have it on their website to check them out. They are fantastic looking, by far the best of the signature jerseys in the CFL, because there's been some bad ones that have came out this year.
Yeah.
These ones are pretty slick looking. I don't think there will be a lot of complaints about these, aside from maybe the odd pistols on the shoulder that someone got offended about it, but I wouldn't be too offended. These are very good looking jerseys.
Yeah. As well, this afternoon, of course, Scott Mitchell from the Calgary Sun will join us, and he'll concentrate a little bit more on the Stampeders. Arash Madani is the man around the league, and we'll ask him the magical question. So where are the Hamilton Tiger Cats playing this weekend? Are they in their new stadium? Are they going to be playing like in Toronto? Are they going to be playing at McMaster? Maybe on a street corner at Barton and Cannon?
High school field somewhere.
So we'll ask Arash that.
Maybe the camera angles will be better if they play at a high school field than they are at McMaster.
Oh,
it's tough watching a game
not good
on television from McMaster.
It sort of looks like educational TV. Yeah,
it does.
Yeah, not the best. And Rob Kerr joins us at 2 o'clock to add. What does Rob Kerr add to the broadcast? He adds everything.
Everything. A little bit of everything.
He is the paprika on this broadcast. He spices things up, and he'll be along to talk. Not a big golfer, but we'll also want to talk a little bit about the news out of Edmonton today.
Yeah, Justin Schultz.
Justin Schultz getting a new contract. Interesting, Josh. Just 1 year, though.
Again, it goes, you're seeing it with guys across the league when they're young like Justin Schultz coming off these entry-level deals. Unless you're a superstar player coming out of your entry-level, if you're a Patrick Kane, Jonathan Toews, Sidney Crosby kind of player, you're going to get a long-term contract coming out of your entry-level deal. But you have to be something special to get a long-term deal, because we've seen it with lots of guys, bridge deals. We see it here with the Flames. The GMs maybe don't like calling them bridge deals, but that's kind of what we've named them in the media. You had your first 3 years, and for Justin Schultz, mediocre, okay, didn't really blow your doors off like everyone thought he would. Never, you know, when everyone
good
was
first hurt. Year,
a great first year, kind of, you know, maybe step back a little bit, but you're still a guy that they believe in that could be, according to Craig McTavish, a Norris Trophy winner in the very near future. But you haven't proven yourself long term yet. What kind of player are you? Haven't really shown what you are going to be consistent. So you give him those 1 year deals. Now you got to show yourself that you are. This is what you are. Show us that you're a great player that can, you are a guy that can be a consistent great defenseman in the NHL, or are you going to be a guy that's maybe struggled the last couple of years? We've seen it with a Joe Colburn here in Calgary, yep. Michael Backlund, TJ Brody. They didn't get long-term deals coming out of, they all got these little bridge contracts, so they can still prove what they are. And that same sort of thing is what I would expect the Oilers are doing here.
Well, this is what you're supposed to do. I mean, we missed, what, half a season for a new collective bargaining agreement.
Yep.
They built in things that the clubs are supposed to use. The Oilers, of course, famously gave their core guys right out of entry level. They gave them 5-year deals or 6-year deals with $5 million per. I mean, they blew right through that. So however you feel about how the Canadians have treated P.K. Subban, and frankly, I don't like a lot of the things that they've done with him, I had no problem with them forcing him to do the bridge contract on his original contract coming out. Exactly what you said. Prove yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Show us you're the guy we think you're going to be. Now, the fact that he just went through, he showed who he could be, and they still didn't want to pay him is is another thing. But I would think, too, the TJ Brody has to be interested in seeing the progress of guys like this, too.
Yeah, and I mean,
financially.
TJ Brody's got 2 years on his deal. His first year's done. He's got that last year of his contract right now before he becomes an RFA at the end of this upcoming season. And for TJ Brody, he's done his entry level. He has that bridge contract. He's showing that he's got a lot of potential, and they believe that he can be a top-tier defense in the NHL. Have a great season this year with the Flames, and you'll probably get yourself maybe a 4 or 5 year deal, because TJ Brody especially is a guy the Flames, I would think, are very interested in keeping here long term to be maybe the future, one of their future guys, anchors on that back end. Maybe once a guy like Mark Giordano is ready to move on or take a step back, maybe the torch would be passed to a guy like TJ Brody. So if TJ Brody could have another good year, he'll find himself a long term deal. Michael Backlund, a little bit sketchy because it's only been half a season really last year, a bit over half a season, really had a good year, showed that what he really is, what he can be. Again, you have that 1 year left this season, show us what you can be, and you'll probably get yourself a longer-term deal as well.
Now, we need to take a break here, dude. Now, did I also see on the schedule that we were supposed to be joined by Brian Burke, too?
Brian Burke going to come in around 2:20 this afternoon.
Now, is he here?
No, I don't think he's here. I believe he's joining us on the phone. Seems like the off-season summer cleaning, I guess, is done for the Flames now that Lance Boehm has signed. So we'll get his thoughts of going into camp.
Thought maybe he'd come in a chopper on the practice green here. You know, the Flames chopper.
That would be. If you don't see a chopper coming down here, it's probably Brian Burke.
So that's Brian Burke just after 2 in the 2 o'clock hour, and we're joined by Rob Kerr. Bruce Dobing and the Doughboy with you. It's Josh Humphries. You're listening to The Big Show live from the Shaw Charity Classic at Canyon Meadows. Back after this.
NHL, CFL, NFL, MLB, NLL, WHL, and lots more letters. We cover them all. Sportsnet 960, the FAN. Talking sports in the afternoon. This is The Big Show on Sportsnet 960, The Fan.
I dedicate that to my brother. You know, it was so hard being on the field during the game, and I don't know how I do it, to be honest with you. But I know my brother was there, and I have to, just give that and honor that for him. That was all him.
There you go, Joe West from last week's game. If you don't know the story, just shortly before kickoff time in Ottawa, he was informed his younger brother had been killed and decided to go ahead and play the game. And, of course, if you saw the game, he played a heck of a game.
Unbelievable.
His teammates, again, if you saw the video afterwards, his teammates, giving him the support afterwards.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether he's changed his mind since about whether he should have played or not, but he did play, and if such a thing as a tribute to his brother, that was a tribute to his brother, how well he played.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really up for debate for us. I mean, Joe West thought he was okay to play. He thought that was the best way. I don't know Joe West personally or his brother, so tough for me to maybe say whether he shouldn't or shouldn't have played. I think nobody's really in that position to say that except for Joe West, if he should have played or not. But he did play, and he had a great game. He made some unbelievable catches, really kick-started the Stampeder offense, I think, in that game as well. At that point, they were kind of struggling until Bo Levi Mitchell hit him with that big 58-yard pass over the middle that he made that big catch on. So I think for Joe West, it was great to play, great way to honor his brother. I think around the entire league, they really understand and realize what Joe West did by playing in that game, what it meant to him. He gets the CFL Player of the Week honors. You mentioned the teammates, during the game and after the game, on the sidelines or just everywhere around Joe West, rallying around him. It was a really cool sign of solidarity to see from the members of the Calgary Stampeders to be with their teammate and show that they had he had their support.
It's always hard to know what to do in these cases. I mean, right now, of course, there's the fairly notorious case in NASCAR, where My mind's got driven a blank. The driver who killed the other driver.
Yeah, Stewart. Tony Stewart.
Tony Stewart. Yes. Sorry, total mind blank. Anyhow, Tony Stewart, in the lieu of that, he was saying he was gonna race the mm-hmm. next day after having killed this guy with the car, and almost up till race time, it seemed like he and his crew were ready to go, and then they pulled back from it, and now I think he seems to have been talked off of that edge about racing until he's ready, and now I think the totality of what happened in that situation has hit him. He's coming back this week, which I think is, 3 weeks is, that's a good time to mourn and to grieve and take into account. But for him to have raced right away, having done what he did, that's tough. But we've seen this many times where athletes have had a personal tragedy. The Stanley Cup playoffs this year, perhaps. You could almost make the case that the unfortunate passing of Marty St. Louis' mother was the catalyst for the Lightning to go on a run because it inspired him and it gave the team something to bond around.
It is. I mean, these things can rally. We've seen guys play Brett Favre, the Monday Night Football game, when his dad passed away. Yep. We saw him kind of come out and play that game as well. So I think there's certain things like this, and I mean, some of us would probably be in a position where we'd be grieving. It'd be very tough for us. We probably wouldn't play to be with family and things like that. But other of us, we don't know, who Brett Favre's dad or Joe West's brother or anything like that. Maybe that is what they would have wanted, for that guy to go play and have a good game in his honor. And we've seen it happen before, and that's exactly what Joe West did. He had that game. Marty St. Louis, the entire Ranger team rallying around him, getting to the Stanley Cup Finals. They all went to the funeral with him, kind of playing that whole entire playoff run in Marty St. Louis' mother's honor. And same thing we see. And so, I understand where some people say it, we shouldn't play at all, but if these guys think it's the right thing to do, it's their lives, their careers, their family, they would know best. And sometimes they come out and have big games like that and honor them, maybe, and that's the best way to do it.
Here comes the naked plug from my Grant Fuhr book, A Grant Fuhr Portrait of Champion. One of the chapters discusses 1986, start of the playoffs for the Edmonton Oilers. Grant Fuhr's father passed away. His father, Bob, passed away. His dad was sick a very short time. And Grant had won the first game. He'd been in goal for the first game as the Oilers defeated, I believe it was the Vancouver Canucks, fairly handily in the first game of the 86 series. Mm-hmm. And then he literally sat with his dad at bedside in the hospital till about 3 in the morning. But there was no sense for Grant that his dad had, there was anything imminent with his dad. And then, of course, he got up the next morning and found out his dad had passed away. And Grant had to face that situation, and we talk about it in the book, but what should he do? And his initial instinct was he wanted to play.
Yeah.
He said, my dad was a hockey fan. My career and the Oilers were his passion. What better way to reward him than by playing? And up until game time, it looked like he was going to play, and then I guess there were some discussions off ice with Glenn Sather and some other people, and it turned out that Andy Moog ended up playing the game, and Grant just sat and watched it. There's no right or wrong. I mean, and asking Grant about it for the book, I mean, there's no right or wrong answer for what you should do or what you shouldn't do. Mm-hmm. In retrospect, I think he still would have played.
Yeah.
He still would have liked to have played for his dad, but also understands why some people felt like he should just, take a day off.
Take a day off, and that's definitely heavily on your mind. There's no doubt about it. You're distracted in playing those games. There's no doubt about you're distracted. There's no possible way you could be 100% focused on the game, but maybe just the motivation of knowing that, if you're, a religious guy and you believe, he's watching down on you that day at the, on the court, on the field or on the ice that day. And it would make him so proud to be able for you to come out and play a game. That's what he loved to do. So maybe you want to play just because of that. And maybe it gives you the motivation, because you're certainly not 100% focused, but it does give you a lot of motivation.
Well, enough of this. Let's get away from this theme. I mean, I think let's not bring down the entire room. It's just a tribute to Joe West, as we say.
Yeah.
And we'll
Who
see.
Who is going to play on Monday again?
We'll see where. Yeah, exactly. And of course, Mo Price is supposed to be back.
Mo Price will be back. Yeah.
We're going to see the Stampeder team that we thought we would see back in July, until the injury started happening. And look, that's football too. But it's a good time to have all hands on deck, because not only anytime Edmonton shows up, it's great to have good all hands on deck. But an Edmonton team that arrives here 7-1, and I think, in my own humble opinion, maybe playing a little above their pay grade, you want to have all hands on deck, and you want to let them know just where they stand.
and we don't know their quarterback situation right now. Doesn't look good for Mike Riley that he's going to start.
Didn't practice today, I believe.
He did practice today, but reports coming from Morley Scott up in Edmonton, I believe, that Matt Nichols was taking part in the majority of the first-team reps, and Mike Riley wasn't really throwing the ball at all, if at all, in today's practice. So it's Friday, a couple days before the game, and Mike Riley's not participating in full practice right now. Almost not safe to say, but there's a good chance we could see Matt Nichols come in as the backup quarterback for the Eskimos in this game.
Now, Marcel Marceau over here is giving me an indication that apparently something wrong with the arm.
It's passing. Yeah, it is his passing.
Mr. Riley tough. Apparently can't throw.
Cannot throw the ball.
Now do the man in the box. Do the man in the box. There you go. That's our crack researcher. He'll join us at 2 o'clock when he interviews Brian Burke. I think this is probably the most, and there'll be some pantomime there too, I believe you. I think this is the most anticipated battle of Alberta, quote unquote, for the CFL for a while.
Especially for a Labor Day game.
Yeah.
This is huge.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be something else. I can't wait for the atmosphere there. There's so many different things to be excited about, whether it's the 7-1 records, John Huffnagel versus Chris Jones once again. And now I think for the first time in the public, we saw the bad blood that might be between these two guys when they didn't shake hands or refused to shake hands after the game up in Edmonton. So you have that whole thing. The Stamps beating the Eskimos earlier this season. There's that. The 7-1 records. There's just so much. The Stamps' new jerseys they're going to debut. Or they debuted them today. They released them to the public, but wear them for the first time. There's just so many things if you're a Stampeders fan or an Eskimos fan to really get excited about this game. This game doesn't need hype at all because it's Labor Day. It never needs hype. It's a Labor Day game. But now, there's just all that added extra stuff to it this season.
I'm trying to figure out when the spare from Edmonton goes streaking. That's, you know, that's always a Labor Day tradition.
There's always a streaker there.
It's always some spare from Edmonton who comes down and decides that the world has to get a look at him, more of him than we really need to see, and he goes
and it's
running
a,
out there.
A 7-1 game, so you know it's going to happen this year.
Some sort of distraction.
I wonder if, like, Bodog would ever put odds on that, if you can bet on that. Because you can bet on just about anything else.
For the Super Bowl.
For the Labor Day game, we could bet that there would be a streaker. Yes or no?
Yeah.
Know, the well, over-under.
There's one for the Bodog people. We'll see. Be interesting to just see the turnout, too. This has not been a classic CFL season yet. We
nope.
have not had vintage games that are going to go down in history. The league needs a showcase, a marquee game on Monday. I mean, they really need to see this game, and they need to be played well, and they want to see that. They want to see the stands full, because Lord knows the Hamilton team, you know, they may be playing in front of friends and family in some sort of yard somewhere. So we need to see in the early. So we really need to see
it's
something
almost,
there.
Yeah, it's like the league's really banking on this game being that classic game that the league really needs to, you know, pick up their socks this year. It's and I mean, you speaking of the Toronto Hamilton, if they don't play, I mean, there's rumors that they might go to Tuesday.
Yeah.
What does that do for the league? I think that would really upset the league, because part of that Labor Day is that doubleheader game. You get the Toronto Hamilton in the morning, if you're out here in the West, I guess early, late in the morning, early afternoon, and then it's the Stampeders Eskimos. You're probably losing a good chunk of viewers
for both
games, and you're probably losing like a lot of your tradition and stuff. This is going to be rude if they have to move to a Tuesday.
I'm just speculating here, but I would think that Stu Johnson, who runs TSN, he's probably not in love with the idea of going to Tuesday.
No.
I kind of think they've got their hearts set on the
Especially
Labor Day,
them, yeah.
prime time, because whatever you say about attendance for the CFL, and it's not always the best in Southern Ontario, mm-hmm. people still watch the games. If you look at the ratings, the people still watch the Toronto Argonauts and the Hamilton Tiger Cats on TV. And for them to try to bump that out of there, that would be a serious problem. Maybe this is why Mr. Cohan said he was resigning this week, because he knew this was going to happen. I don't know.
He doesn't want to deal with that headache.
So they don't want to have that happen. But anyhow, the whole thing with the Stampeder season, and we're going to talk about this as we go through the afternoon. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to talk about anything but golf, but on those occasions when Mr. Kerr allows me into the discussion about something else, and we're talking about football. Listen, the whole season has been about Bo Levi Mitchell. It's about getting this guy, keeping this guy upright, giving him as many game situations and as many challenges as he can absorb, so that by the time the playoffs come around, they know what they've got.
Yeah.
To me, an untold story I haven't heard as much about as we should is this guy's been upright most of the season. The offensive line does a great
incredible
job. You know, sometimes, you know, we're positive about Bo Levi, but he's had really, really good opportunities to do his best, because he's not lying flat on his back like some other quarterbacks in this league.
Exactly right, and especially when you're a rookie starter. I mean, he's not a rookie in the CFL, but it's his first year being a starter. John Cornish goes down, Mo Price goes down, Nick Lewis can't play because of the ratio thing. So some of your weapons that you have at your disposal start going down. So the offensive line really has had to pick up their socks and really be protective of him, because it could have been a very difficult. I mean, if you look back on it, if you would have, you know, maybe before it all started, if I would have told you John Cornish is going to be gone long term, Mo Price is going to go, Nick Lewis won't be able to play, Matt Walter's going to go, we're going to lose two or three different running backs, we're going to be tons of injuries. Joe West had a slow start to the season. Jeff Fuller goes down. We're going to say all these things, and we have a rookie in Bo Levi Mitchell starting at quarterback. Would you believe the Stampeders would be 7-1 at this point?
Nope,
probably not. From the outside, if I told you at Labor Day they'd be 7-1, there's no chance you would think that. But again, that goes to Bo Levi Mitchell, the offensive line, the guys that have stepped in. A guy like Cedric Cunningham last week comes out of relatively nowhere, has a punt return for a touchdown, great speed on the wide receiver round end around for the touchdown as well. He steps up. Hugh Charles comes in. Martell Mallett comes in, both over 100 yards in their games. And you really start to think, and then you got to give John Huffnagel and the scouting staff and all these guys credit, because they're the ones that are finding all these guys that they are able to plug in. Dave Dickinson deserves a huge credit because his offense is so, I'm not going to say easy, but it's, you know, guys can come in and adapt to it pretty quick and learn the systems and be able to go into the games and be effective, and still throws defenses on the other side off enough for the Stampeders to win. So it's almost like an entire organization right from the very top, from the general manager spot right through down to the backup and practice roster guys this year, have all contributed to Stampeder victories and why they're 7-1.
Now, you must be correct, because Marcel Marceau is now doing the dog wagging his head in the back of the car thing for you.
Now he's guiding everybody around. I don't know.
He's putting the on-location sign out there. Speaking of location, we are at, of course, Canyon Meadows for the Shaw Charity Classic, the Champions Tour. First round underway. The morning guys have basically are coming in now. We should be getting the first guys finished and coming to the tent here, doing some media availabilities. I'm going to say about 2:30. Joe Durant leads the tournament at the moment through 12 holes. He's got a 6-under par score. Bob Tway, Tom Pernice Jr. are tied at 5-under par. Joe Daly, Woody Austin, Aquaman. Do you remember him falling into the pond?
Yeah. Yes. Yes, I do.
You know, he's won money. He's a good golfer, all that sort of stuff. But you know his obit is gonna have that story in it.
Falling into the pond, yeah.
It could be worse. It could be a bad thing that happened to you. Gary Hallberg is at 3-under par, and he's tied with Scott Hoke. Stephen Ames, the last time we looked, I'm just going down my list here, is still 1-under par. Yes, 1-under par. Rod Spittle, who, of course, we had on Wednesday morning from here, Canadian out of Niagara Falls, he's 1-under par. Jim Rutledge, 1-over par, but still within hailing distance. As the guys told us the other day, though, on this tour where you got only 3 rounds, you can't afford to get 5 strokes down or 6 strokes down after the first round and really expect to make a comeback. You got to kind of stay close to the leaders. Last year, if you remember, Rocco Mediate basically just left the field behind.
Behind him, yeah, he took off.
So you can't get yourself into that situation. Bruce Dobigan, Josh Humphreys, we are live, as I say. When we come back, follow up a little bit, maybe talk some more about that Mr. Schultz thing going on up in Edmonton, the signing and what it means. Oh, don't? Oh, more golf. Okay, sorry. I'm being prompted to talk about more golf by Marcel.
We got a game of charades going on there
Marcel
today.
We're back after this.
Proud home for the Flames and Hitmen. Calgary's hockey station. Sportsnet 960. The Fan. Talking sports in the afternoon. This is The Big Show on Sportsnet 960. The Fan.
.149. Friday afternoon, as we head into the Labor Day weekend. What a great weekend. Champions Golf Tour. We are live here at Canyon Meadows for that. Labor Day game. All sorts of football starting on TV. Sat up late and watched a little bit of NCAA football last night, because I kind of like that stuff. Lots to talk about as we go through the afternoon. Brian Burke joins Rob Kerr at 2 o'clock. 3 o'clock, of course, it's Football Fridays. Arash Madani, and then Scott Mitchell of the Calgary Sun. We're going to talk about Justin Schultz, but my friend Renee here, who is sitting behind me, he said that topic stinks. What are you talking about the Oilers for? Oilers? What are you? I thought this was a Calgary station. I said, you know what? He's right. I said, well, tell me, Renee, what should we talk about? And he said, what about these four teams, these expansion teams? What's going on? What are you hearing? So there you go. You need some audio. I'm not hearing you.
How about now?
There we go. You were left speechless. Now you're good.
Now we're good.
Talking about the four, it's gone from like one. There was the sort of talk maybe Seattle would get a team, or maybe they transfer somebody to Quebec City. Now apparently the established wisdom is four teams.
Yep.
Quebec City, Seattle, Vegas, Southern Ontario.
Yeah. And well, maybe.
And maybe Kapuskasing.
Four expansion teams, or whether it be two expansion, two relocations, whatever. I just don't think it's really would work if you go four teams at once, that kind of an expansion nowadays. I think that'd be too much. Because there's always, I mean, Rob had the big conversation about, you know, things being too watered down in the league, and, you know, these new teams would not be very good at all. But if you go four teams at once, I think that nowadays that wouldn't work very well. But I think if you go two teams at a time, I think you'd still be okay. For me, the one that to me doesn't really make, I mean, it makes sense in a way, but I don't see it happening is Vegas.
Yeah.
And I know that's the one that everyone's, oh, it's guaranteed, and Dan Patrick was on there, and it's a done deal. It's going to happen. Somebody's going to Vegas, whether it's expansion or a relocation. But to me, it just, I don't know, I was interested in your opinion. I just don't think Vegas could really work. I mean, if it works so well and it can work, then why hasn't it been done yet? Why has no other sport put a pro team there? I mean, you have minor league teams, but why is there not a pro team there?
See, this is, I mean, this is, there's a lot of arguments here, and we can get into this as we go through the afternoon. But the big problem for the NHL has been expansion has always been too easy. Mm-hmm. For Gary Bettman, who has to keep his owners happy, it's been an easy way to basically bring in found money.
Yeah.
And bring in new teams. And the logic of the time was, well, this is a regional sport, and we need to be in more regions so we can get regional TV. It's not about regional TV the way it used to be. The real big money, as we see in soccer and the NFL and those types of things, is national and international broadcasting type of thing. So to me, to water down your product some more, just so you get a couple of pipsqueak new teams that are never going to win. The other thing is that you've got the Stanley Cup. If you're Gary Bettman and the NHL, what do they sell? They sell the prestige of the Stanley Cup. It's because of the cup and how special it is. If you've got 32 teams or 34 teams, people are never going to see that stupid cup.
Yeah.
You're going to have a whole lot of people going to say, we're never going to win. I give up on that. There's too many teams. It's like, what, does he want to have it like the March Madness where you get 64 teams every year? I just don't understand. To me, you need an NHL that has 20, 24 teams in a premiership division where the best players play, the best teams, the biggest teams, and you push that product that way. And this, to me, is just like skating along on the same old, same old.
Well, for you, I mean, is that the number 24 teams where you have just the absolute best players playing? And then is that the number two?
Well, I said 20 to 24.
20 to 24.
The premiership is 20, I believe,
right?
And in England and Europe and with soccer, they don't care that the same five or six teams win almost all the time. It doesn't seem to bother them. The networks love it. The sponsors love it. Even the teams that get their ears boxed still love it because you get these great teams that show up and you see them at your park.
But, I mean, if NHL, I mean, we and Rob had the conversation, too, of what league would be like if nowadays there were six teams. You would have six pretty good all-star teams going out. It would be unbelievable.
Yeah.
But if you had 20 to 24 teams, you would still have some really good, because that's six teams losing their star players. I mean, maybe that's the number that you would have. Great hockey, because you would have 24 teams that would be pretty evenly matched with a lot of talent on each of those teams, and you're also not taking away where there's still some superstars that may find themselves out of work because there's not enough teams.
And I mean, immediately, I know our smarter listeners out there, I know Renee pointed out this earlier, he saw the flaws in this, which is both the union and the league like more teams. The union likes more jobs. The league likes more markets and more logos and things that they can sell. But to me, at the end of the day, it's a short-term strategy. And they're not the only ones. It was the way you organized a sports league in the 60s and 70s. You expanded. You had new markets, new teams, new logos, etc. But the watching the World Cup soccer this past year just struck me how many people. Like, I'd listen to ESPN, and they do their updates, and they'd be talking about European soccer. And I'm going, they don't even talk about hockey. And they're talking about European soccer. Kids wearing jerseys, wearing Messi jerseys or Cristiano Ronaldo. I mean, to me, they've understood, the soccer people understand, it's about star power. Yeah. That's where the big money is. So will Vegas work? Would Seattle work? I mean, I think there's arguments to be made for all of them that if they get some success, they can work. But if you're and you don't expand the playoffs, it seems to me like there's a lot of unhappy teams and a lot of unhappy fans every year by adding extra teams.
Yeah, and it makes it interesting because you have, I mean, more teams and more, and like you said, more regional markets. To me, the Vegas thing just doesn't work. And you know, I talked about, you know, pro sports hasn't gone there, and you know, minor pro teams do, and someone texted in the posse from the CFL. Yeah. Well, that worked very well. I mean, that's a great text. Yeah, the Las Vegas posse were so successful down there. So,
well, that's where Anthony Calvillo started.
That's where he starts, but I mean, that
for 15 minutes.
That didn't work whatsoever. I mean, would you consider a CFL and one of the top four, you know, pro sports teams like the NHL, baseball, basketball, or football? No, you wouldn't. So, I don't know. I mean, that text doesn't make a lot of sense to make that argument. The Las Vegas posse went to Vegas.
Well,
I
it's
mean,
a bit of a.
They were there a year, 2 years, yeah. And they left. They, like every other American, it didn't work.
It's a bit of, I mean, Vegas is a bit of a shift worker and union town.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously the casinos and that will buy up boxes to have their high rollers, their whales, as they like to call them. They'll yeah. send them to the boxes and stuff. But by and large, it's not a town where people make a ton of money, the average Joes. And there's a lot of people who work shift work, which corresponds with exactly when hockey games would be on.
And, yeah, and I mean, your season ticket base would be very, very low in a place like that. You're basically banking on tourists coming to games to watch the visiting team is what you're banking on, is your visiting teams to sell out the arenas. And, sure, I mean, when a team like Calgary or Vancouver goes, lots of people would go. But would the novelty kind of wear off after a couple of years of you going to Vegas every year to watch your team play once or twice a season? I think that would wear off. And teams like the Florida Panthers or those teams, they don't have a lot of fan base to begin with, so right. They're not going to be sending a lot of people. So what happens when Vegas and the Florida Panthers play on a Wednesday night in Las Vegas? You think they're going to get anybody to go to that game? Yeah. Probably not.
Again, the future to me, as I say, is fewer teams, and also, you know, really pounding the big tournaments, like a World Cup tournament and the Olympic thing or whatever replaces the Olympics, and pounding that every 2 years so that you get world audiences tuning in. Again, if it's about a business, if it's just about having as many people having NHL teams, as I said, let's have one in Kapuskasing. Let's have one in Coronation. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know, let's have everybody have a team. But it doesn't work that way, and it shouldn't work that way. And my concern is just that Gary Bettman wants to go out in a blaze of glory, hand the owners a big, big check for four expansion relocation teams, and then he retires. And this is all well and good for Gary Bettman's retirement plan, but what does it say for hockey and where hockey goes afterwards? Mm-hmm. If Bill Daly succeeds him, what is Bill Daly left with?
He inherits, and then you're going to have some contractions to do, probably, because I don't think a 34-team league could really survive, especially the NHL, because maybe if you brought him into Canada, but you have to find four markets for that to work. But I don't think a 34-team is ideal.
Well, and here's the other thing about it, and I think we discussed this back when the TV contract was signed, is it's a 10-year deal with NBC. And it's all the digital and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. That's already been sold away. I would be very concerned if I'm an NHL owner after 5 years if all of a sudden there's something new that comes along that NBC sort of says, sorry, you signed us for 10 years. We got 5 years where we're going to take all the cream away, and you're sitting there looking like you were just chasing a quick buck.
Yeah.
And they didn't – I mean, what do they get, $200 million a year for the league, I think, for the NBC deal? It's $2 billion for 10 years. So it's not a ton of money.
Yeah.
Not a ton of money. So, I mean, there's concerns there. Rob can bring it up with Brian. He'll take it up with Brian Burke. Yeah, he'll be talking to the Flames president in a couple of minutes when he joins us here on the Big Show. Bruce Dobick and Josh Humphreys. Don't forget Football Fridays at 3:00. We are live on location. We have a sign that says so. So we must be. We are at Canyon Meadows for the Shaw Charity Classic. Just a fabulous afternoon here this afternoon. Lots of fans. If you want to come out and see the tournament, Fred Couples and Stephen Ames playing together in a group, might be hard to see them. The crowds are there, but lots of access to lots of other people. Joe Duranta has the lead still through 13 holes. And hopefully about, 3:30, 4:00-ish, the guys will start coming into the tent, and we'll have some live interviews with some people as we go through the afternoon. So that's it for this hour. When we come back, Brian Burke and much, much more here on The Big Show.